Welcome to the Creative Play and Podcast Network. Join us as we share our favorite RPGs, one-shot games, tabletop games, reviews, and convention panels. Sit back and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Kelly, aka Trixie from Ragnarok and Roll, assigned to Ragnarok Story, and Tilda Wimblewick from D&D Journey of the 5th Edition. First off, I would just like to say thank you to everyone for listening to our varied adventures, as well as for rating us on iTunes and RPGpodcast.com. If you haven't rated us yet, we would greatly appreciate it if you could. And if you're looking for more ways to support our efforts, we are now on Patreon, a great site where you can help us continue making more podcasts, as well as some special surprises for our patrons. If you can, please look us up at www.patreon.com/cppn. Every little bit helps. And again, thank you for listening.
And I'm like, I'm somewhere in between. So, well, we can introduce ourselves and say why we're decided we wanted to be on this panel. I'm Jenny Kisubner. I'm best known for the Bones of Fairy trilogy, which has...
No, you're not supposed to close it completely in our rotation. Yeah.
So, best known for the Bones of Fairy trilogy, which set in a world where any tech that could have fueled AI or anything else has been destroyed. It's a post-apocalyptic magical story. But I have also been doing some AI training, escape work, basically trying to train various generative AI systems to be more honest and less harmful. Mm. In large part by asking them questions and then choosing from among their answers. And I did that in large part because I wanted to, you know, it was clear this is something we're going to be talking about more and more, and I wanted to know how it actually worked. There was a chance to get paid for actually working with some of the generative AI models.
I'm Jim Doty. I write science fiction and fantasy under my initials, J.L. Doty. I have 17 or 18 published novels, a mixture of self-published and traditionally published with Open Room Media and HarperCollins. And I have a new series coming out next year, The Dreadmark Covenants. The four books in the series are going to be released 3 months apart. And it's a story of a little boy who has a birthmark on his arm, and you know, is it the is it just a smear of discolored skin, or is it an ancient curse? We'll see what happens. I'm also a scientist, PhD, electrical engineering. My specialty is laser physics. I've been writing programming code for 56 years. I'm so old that St. Peter sent me his manuscript. Asked me to have a look at it. And I'm the AI curmudgeon here. I'm gonna say nay.
I'm gonna say be cautious, but it's here. And I don't know if you wanna focus. The focus is supposed to be on how artists get paid, but that's like one small, and you can start there, I guess. We're still working that out, I think.
Yeah. Well, they have a contract. I haven't heard what it'll be.
I haven't heard the details yet.
The actors. And if, the screenwriters have a contract. Yes.
And the word on both of them is they're still going to be working out some of the details, but they have the broad outline that they can agree upon enough to end the fight.
I mean, the payment side, the impression I get, you know, is the big issue is that AIs, they're not cut and pasting existing works, but they are training on them and learning the probabilities of different phrases showing up. And the question is, what compensation are creators entitled to, not just, you know, fiction and other prose, but art, for having their work used as training data? It's not quite the same as photocopying your work and selling it, but it's not the same as not using your work at all.
Yeah, and with the actors, it was also taking the images, and because of what AI can do with the deep fake technology, you know, they would be able to put an image of an actor into some other thing that they had not participated in any at all. And so you've got the actor's likeness, but the actor doesn't get paid for it.
But I'm not worried about that. That is so blatant that I think that's easily defensible in a or sueable in a.
Yeah.
So first off, let's remember, you can sue anyone, anywhere, anytime, for any reason whatsoever.
Yeah.
And if you find a lawyer who's willing to take your money, that means he's not willing to take a percentage of the take, which means he knows you're going to lose.
Yeah.
All right. But you can sue anyone, anywhere, anytime. It might get thrown out in the preliminary hearing because it's baseless, right?
Yeah.
Well, so I'm pretty sure Sir Laurence Olivier's estate was all for it when he did Sky Captain. But that was really startling when you see that the first time. It's like, okay, this is a dead guy. And that was quite a few years ago, but I mean, how that would pertain to the future and how they can get away with it would be interesting.
I'm not familiar with that.
Sir Laurence Olivier had a part toward the end in Sky Captain and World of Tomorrow. It was with Angelina Jolie and a few others. It was made quite a few years ago. Figure out what year it was made.
So in that's probably covered by the fact that, you know, he, whatever rights he had are inheritable by his estate.
Exactly.
Okay. And it's a little, so certain kinds of rights are perpetual. Copyrights.
What is it, 25 years?
Copyrights now in 95 years after the creator's death. So as a property that can be inherited, it goes away 95 years.
I know the Happy Birthday ladies who did the original Happy Birthday are still, their estate are still having issues with that.
I think they've recently proved that they weren't the ones, and I have to look up the details.
Really? Oh, because I know.
Who had created that, it wasn't as clear cut who created that song as it used to be, but don't take my word for that.
No, I know. I've worked a lot of different F&B, and they actually designed their own for that specific reason.
So I think the real issue that we're facing, and I'm going to use Google as an example, it was always, I just finished writing 2.5 books, and I got to write another 1.5. And every week I wonder, I binge write. So I'm writing for 12, 14 hours a day, and my wife, I'm never supposed to point at her, but she's in the room. My wife has to come in and say, "Damn it, Jim, dinner's ready. Stop writing." You know? And but you wonder, all right, what happens if the house burns down? You know, what if I, you know, and so I, you know, thought, okay, well, Google offers me 15 gigabytes of free cloud. It's cloud storage, and we go in and you click that little box that says I've read the terms and conditions, and I agree to those terms and conditions, and I'm one of those weird people who I actually read the manual before I actually turn on my new toy.
Yes.
I'm just, and I read the terms and conditions, and in Google's terms and conditions to use their cloud storage, I give them full rights to scan all my manuscripts and use them and for whatever purposes they choose, except for directly publishing them and something like that. It's that kind of stuff. So if I unload this up, so I looked at how, okay, what I could do is I could zip them in a carefully encoded file that they can't get into, but I can't upload them that way, right?
Oh.
And it turns out that all these cloud storage services, most of them have something like that. Adobe offers a bunch of cloud storage, and they're.
It's been a while since I read. I use Dropbox, but I'm sure there's something in there.
Well, Dropbox is different. That's more for transmitting to someone else, isn't it?
It's also storage. I mean, I've been using this storage, but you can also share links to things that you have up there.
I guess for me, I understand the concern about training on your data and worried about that somehow this is going to get plagiarized in a sense, but you know, I've taken like courses in neural networks, and I have some understanding of how this actually works. And its probability is at such a raw level that your words are in there, but they're it's like taking, like, I have a pink dye, a green dye, a purple dye, and I throw it all in one pot, and you have this whole mixture, and you're worried about whether or not your pink dye is going to be showing. Not really. I mean, you'll maybe have like some phrasing that might be there a little bit, but it mixes things in for so many different sources that
I'm not worried about direct plagiarism. I mean, it's not going to, and you know, I checked and my books are in the database that was used, Books 3, which is one of the databases of pirated books that have been used to inform some of the AIs. I suspect all of them are using them, and yeah, I'm not worried that like it's going to be able to write my books. I think we're in this new area of copyright law. To me, the question is, what is the compensation that a writer is entitled to, or any creative, for providing work that helped to train? I don't think it's plagiarism. I don't think it's like you should pay me for, you know, you're not publishing my book. But, and I think this is something we haven't worked out. Should there be some sort of compensation for lending your data for training? And maybe that compensation is just the same as if someone buys a book from you. Maybe it's
nothing. But the other issue is there's Ross's extreme example of they use an actor's actual face and they use AI to generate it. That's pretty clear. And then if I take your example, go to the extreme of, you know, they use a couple of the words the and or and nor and but, okay, that's pretty extreme. That's clear. Where do we draw the line? And that's a big question that is going to be very difficult. Where do we draw the line? Do we say, okay, you know, if it may not be exactly the actor's face, but I can recognize that they are representing that actor, and therefore that actor gets compensation. You know, I just made that up.
Like,
is that where we draw the line?
So are we going to fall back then on the trademark principle of reasonable confusion? A reasonable person would find the two instances, the two exemplars. Sorry, I caught.
That's one line.
So that's one line. Yeah, no, but I'm just curious because I'm an IP attorney. So I'm just absolutely fascinated.
You should be up here almost.
So you
no, I can't be up there.
So please, anytime I start telling lies, feel free to call me.
No, I wouldn't do that anyway.
My
take is becoming that it's a new area of IP law, and we have to define.
We have to
we have to decide what we're going to.
This is a long story, but I'm going to be at OpenAI's headquarters, and I'm actually negotiating this point with their general counsel for copyright on Tuesday.
Oh, awesome!
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure. Do you want to?
You're going to be on their side.
No. Not necessarily. No.
No, I didn't get voted the most hated lawyer in America in 2012 by the Wall Street Journal because I work for the big guys. I'd be a lot better paid. But no, I mean, I'm full disclosure. I represent about 8,000 different right holding organizations. I don't know yours in particular, but it's a lot of RROs, Bloomberg, Reuters, Getty Images, like that. And the long story less long is that the interesting argument that they put forth, I can share the argument that they put up. Their argument, the AI provider's argument, is that what they actually produce is such a highly processed thing. They use the kind of classic law school example of chicken and chicken McNuggets, right? I sell chicken McNuggets, and you're telling me that I need to pay you royalties because maybe my chicken McNugget has a piece of your prized Rhode Island red. Okay, well, in order to first do that, we have to have a way for me to take my chicken McNugget and turn it back into a chicken. Okay. Right. We'll acknowledge the fact that would be messed up chicken, but the fact of the matter is that then we have to figure out which kind of chicken was it, and then was it your chicken? Yeah.
But that's one legal argument. Wait a minute,
that's their argument.
That's one legal argument, and so our legal system is intentionally designed to be an adversarial system here in this country, and so the lawyers on that side, their job is to advocate in an adversarial way against their opponents. It's not a let's get together and do a win-win situation. I'm not a lawyer, but I have been part. I've worked in the telecommunications industry for 40 years, and I've led teams and I've been part of teams negotiating multi-year contracts with large corporations where you have to deliver 5,000 units a month at $1,000 a unit for the next five, these kinds of contracts that are multi-hundred million dollar contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't let the lawyers negotiate the contracts. We learned a long time ago that if we put all the adversaries in a room, they get adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
And so those of us who spent 40 years reading contracts, we know a little bit about it, all right? And so we get in the room and we agree that nothing's binding and we're gonna negotiate the terms of the contract, and then we let the people like him who really know how to write the contract in a proper way, you know, here's the five bullet points, now you turn it into 400 pages of contract.
I'm curious, what are the other arguments that you're hearing?
The other arguments with regard to derivation?
The first argument is, by the way,
the reason why I'm in that room is precise. My whole career has kind of been built by being the unlawyer, right? So
being the what?
The unlawyer.
Okay.
Right? So like I don't practice like a regular law firm. I've never been in a big firm. It's because the way that you get things done is by coming in as, so I come in as a business person first. I just happen to have a legal acumen and a technical background too. So. What happens is that the real high stakes IP stuff, like when you have like Sony licensing their catalog to Nokia or Ericsson, they go under there's this particular rule of evidence where you can basically have sidebar conversations with each other without it becoming discoverable or going anything. And so that's the kind of conversations that you have. Not a lot of people know these things take place, and they definitely do not involve the rank and file lawyers because they do exactly what about. And you get lawyers billing lawyers, and the only thing that happens is you make more lawyering. It's a total waste.
Yeah. I personally experienced that.
Yes,
it wasn't
certainly
my pocketbook that they were billing, but the company I was working for, we finally threw our hands up in frustration,
mm-hmm.
and
we were
getting drunk one night,
yeah,
after about the 14th or 15th night of the lawyers being in the room, the kind I was describing, you know, and they just kept coming out of the room, screaming at each other.
The big tech executives have figured
literally, we're on the 54th story of a building in Manhattan, and they come out of the room screaming at each other. And I mean, mm-hmm. this is a big, big law firm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And there were about five or six of us, and we got really drunk one night, and somebody said, let's get rid of the lawyers and we'll let them write it up. And we literally worked out about a $50 million contract on the back of a piece of napkin.
That's how it really does happen at the top end nowadays, is that they figure it out, because they got tired. No one wants to pay a bunch of, that process doesn't work.
We went to them, we literally handed them a napkin and said,
yep, that's
know,
the way you get it done.
You know,
yep.
Now you guys get in the room and negotiate the terms, and they would still come out of the room screaming.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Yes.
And there'd be some snag, and then they'd go away and we'd have the issue they gave us, and then we'd come back and say, okay,
here's the solution.
Here's the snag that we, you know, here's our solution. Now you write that in the contract.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what are the other arguments that?
Yeah. Sure. So the first one is that the product is, like I said, sufficiently derivative that it's no longer, it's not,
right.
They don't even have to fall to the level of being a derivative work that they produce. That's their first line of defense. Their second line of defense is fair use, that they found this through, like in the case of, I'm gonna tell you, so the books, whatever.
Books three, whatever.
So I'm gonna let you know the worst kept secret in the business, which is that they all have it.
Oh, I assume.
They all have it. They have a.
It's just that the
they
one.
Have it, they have it. They have a. There's a data.
The
Books
3 one was trying to be generous and make it publicly available to everyone.
Yeah, but it's worse than
that
though, because it's not just OpenAI. So I don't think I'm talking explicitly about them. There were a couple of large tech companies that have AI, DeepMind, Think. Brain, whatever type, insert, you know, they all make their company names up by putting different combinations of the same four words together. It's kind of disturbing. Oh, gee, they're not really creative, imagine. Putting creators out of business and they're not creative. Who knew? They bought a library from I have a theory which one is a college went out of business. a for-profit college went out of business, and they bought their physical library, and the first thing that they did was they saw the bindings off the books, and they blew them all through a scanner. And that there's another, so there is another books pile that you'll see out there. It's not free. It'll be, I can't tell you the name of it. It has a code name.
I'm assuming there's several
out
there.
It's mostly textbooks and technical books that are out there. But that's your Selviers, your Pruitts, your Harcourt Braces. Those guys are the ones that are they're really mad.
I can't blame them.
But they're saying, well, it was in a library that was publicly available. Therefore, if we can see it, and it was visible for consumption by a member of the public who walked in off the street, they're saying that then they fall back on fair use. That's their second big pillar. And like I said, and then the third one is really not a defense at all. It's that no one knows how to pay us for it. That you can't figure out no one knows how to pay us for it. No one knows how to divvy up this tool. It's not like we're serving impressions of a copyrighted article on a news website like the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times or the Washington Post, where there's a click and I can take how many clicks there were in a month or a week or a day or an hour, and I can use that to divvy up how many percent of that particular viewership should go to you as the author of that article, and we can write you a check for 19 cents or whatever the ridiculous number is, right? They can't even figure that out because of the nature of the process, that there's no way to figure out what your derivation of value should be in a royalty pooling population in the first place. We don't know how to do it. Someone else has to come in and figure it out for us.
I keep thinking of the agreement over, I don't know if it's still in effect or not, but there used to be an agreement where there was compensation basically for photocopying works. Mm-hmm. And they wound up paying the various writers' organizations. So mm-hmm. there was no way to know, how much.
There's the copyright clearing now.
Yes, that's it.
CCC. Yeah.
And I almost wonder if that's the model that makes the most sense. I don't know.
I have. They are at the table.
Are they?
They are at the table. That model is at the table. That is one of the things. We're all figuring it out right now, but there's going to be two tracks. The first track is going to be the, chicken entrails reading smoke and mirror stuff that happens in a boardroom somewhere in Mission District, except California, that will involve people not unlike myself. There will be two kinds of people in the room. I only represent little, small, mid-sized businesses and individuals. That's the only thing I do. I don't do big companies. I'd be a lot better paid if I did, but I just, I like who I am.
It's nice to be able to
look
yourself in the
room. You have a soul.
Well, that's not I do for a living. Did you not get the scent of brimstone? But yes, that is a model, and it's going to come down to that. I would argue, however, that in this case, it's going to be a little challenging to make that work, just because they're still in the copyright and photocopying reproductions clearance realm. One, a lot of that reporting has an element of volunteerism to it, okay? And this, because they figure out how to carve up this pie, right? That's
right.
The problem, is how do you apportion the pie? The second part is that it's the same problem that you have if you're a recording artist or you're a songwriter and you try and get paid. The reason why there's this dark royalty pool is about 26% depending on the year of royalties.
Well, the SCAP.
It's like the lockbox problem, right? There's this box of money, and it's not in the people who are in. So the survey that they do that determines how the Britney Spears or whoever the money get, basically how much money we give to Beyonce and how much money we give to Taylor Swift, and then the rest of us get the federal scraps, I guess, is kind of how it seems to go every year. There's a survey that's done, and it's only like the top 10,000, or 100,000 that really are enlisted in that, and they get a percentage calculated over beer quantities, and that is used to carve out part of it. And then there's everybody else. That long tail is a mess. No one really knows how to capture that. And there's a variety of people that want to do that. Like, there's an idea of extending things like content ID, like the Alphabet YouTube system that they use to find people that have copyrighted content in the background. Figure out what that is. How do you do that with AI? Nobody knows. Like, that is not a technically soluble problem at this point.
And I have heard the argument, it's, in a way, is it just the same as when I read a book and that informs my writing, except it's working
both at a higher speed and with less
That's true.
Precision. You know, I've heard that argument too, that basically the computer
Once you put it in a model, you can't take it out. Like, that's the thing that we can prove that you can't, the model can't unlearn what it's had to put through.
And there's a speed factor. I don't know if that, you know, plays it. You know, it can read more books than I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Although it's really not. I mean, the whole.
I mean, technically, the stuff that like OpenAI and ChatGPT are doing, I mean, technically, most of that's been around for 25 years.
Right.
We're doing stuff like that in my lab in the 90s.
Yeah, it's not new. That's another thing.
That leads me to my curmudgeon point of view.
Okay.
I've had about 10 real experiences with AI in the last 6 to 8 months.
Mm.
And one of them was when ChatGPT first came out, I just went online and said, okay, let's see what this is doing. And then, okay, so I did that. That was AI.
Mm-hmm.
The other nine constitute, let me give you an example of the of one of the other nine. I use a tool called Pro Writing Aid. Okay, it is not generative AI, but it's very good. So I myself have learned to spot the things that I do wrong, and I do them over and over and over again. After 40 years of writing, I still do them, and I go. I spend hours going through my manuscript when I've got it done, identifying, you know, searching out, you know, I'll use this phrase too many times, or I'll use a passive verb on things like that. ChatGPT is really good that even after I do that, I can plug what I've written into ChatGPT and it will help identify passive verbs and, you know, and poor phrasing and things like that. It's very good at that. Now, I've been doing that for a couple of years, and 6 months ago, ChatGPT was not an AI tool, but now it's an AI tool.
Pro Writing Aid.
It's or Pro Writing Aid. I'm sorry, Pro Writing Aid. Now it's an AI tool.
That's crazy.
And the other eight of those nine experiences were the same thing. They're just a bunch of code that 6 months ago was not AI, and as soon as AI came on the scene, now they're all touting what they've got as an AI tool.
Yeah.
And I think my 9 out of 10 sample is low. I think it's more like 99 out of 100 AI tools out there are really not AI. They're just some lines of code, and the marketing guy said, we can sell more of this stuff if we
call it AI.
Pardon me?
It's branded. Yeah, absolutely.
But what you're saying isn't true. It isn't true. So Pro Writing Aid, I've used both Pro Writing and Grammarly. They have new features where they are taking advantage of these large language models and neural networks, where they have pieces of them. Like Grammarly is a thing called Grammarly Go.
Yeah.
And when you have the Grammarly subscription, you get 1,000 of these little things. And basically, you can give it a phrase and it can reword it for you. Quillbox, another one of these. This actually is using neural network and generative AI to do that piece of it. Now, Grammarly,
I have found both of them really bad at rephrasing it.
Well,
extremely bad.
Yeah. Well, it depends.
So, my point is that the value of those tools, and the big value of those tools, is not the AI part of it. It's literally just identifying patterns, all right, simple patterns that are hard to find when you're trying to proofread a 120,000 word manuscript.
Yeah.
And I really think that what we're seeing, the frantic. We've got this frantic jump on the bandwagon situation where the company's marketing teams want to sell more, so they call it AI. They call all of it AI. The news media gets it, they jump on it. And again, I told you, I was around when St. Peter did that.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is that there have been so many of these things over and over again where a year and a half from now, it's going to boil down to a few real specific AI issues, and all of this shit that's going on in the news is news, and the media's need to generate news 24 hours a day, 7 days.
So your curmudgeonness really is not about the AI per se; it's about all this marketing hype around it.
It's. Yeah. I think it's
most
not as. I think a lot of it is not as big a deal.
Mm-hmm.
As it's being made out, and the lawyer in the room seems to agree with me, and I actually do agree with lawyers many times. I didn't mean to pick on your profession.
There is the whole what is AI too, because everything that can be labeled AI is, but it's not all. It's generative AI that people are looking at.
I think a simple way is that is it actually at the end of the day using a neural network somehow?
That is a
Now, not all AI uses neural networks by any means, but the ones that have been successful are somehow based upon a neural network. And these things are using, you know, things that are more complicated than just basic neural networks. But at the end of the day, like as example of Pro Writing Aid, and I have used it before and after this unquote AI introduction, you have a thing called sticky sentences. And so these are sentences that have used, you know, the common words too much, and it'll flag a sticky sentence. Like, well, how can I reword that so it's not sticky? You know, and sometimes your brain doesn't think about it. Older versions of Pro Writing Aid did not do a very good job with that. Newer versions are doing a better job with that. Is it great? Debatable, but that's an example of it having AI inserted into it.
I just used Pro Writing Aid on 280,000 words worth of manuscripts, and I did not see an improvement in their ability to. I constantly rejected their rewriting. It was really good at identifying it and reminding me, oh, I should stop and look at that paragraph.
But I think in a
120,000 word novel, I think I might have accepted their rewrite or a version of it maybe once. They're terrible. They're really terrible at rewriting.
Well, in general, generative AI is not as competent as it's made out to be.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually my concern. I'm not yet concerned my job is going to get taken away by AI. I am concerned that everyone is going to get even worse at believing things that are not true.
Yeah.
Because AI lies, doesn't know it's lying.
That's a really good point.
And that's, I think, the biggest danger, which gets way away from how it pays.
There are agents, and I don't mean that in a government sense. I just mean in terms of like actors.
that are using
some of these raw models that were trained on things like Twitter and Reddit and whatever, precisely because they were trained on garbage data. They're really good at spewing out like really weird stuff
and then lie with
and
conviction.
There are people who they're sometimes having very convincing stuff.
Oh yeah,
that's wrong. Is valuable to certain actors in a dialogue.
I think it's leveling up the whole misinformation where it's,
I mean,
when I've done training, you know, and I'm just trying to get models to tell the truth, you know, it's like, give a model, you know, a question and choose the better response. You know, it's nothing to do with fiction, but occasionally I will get a response that I have to go and double check that I know the answer, but it responds so convincingly that I find myself going, you know, I better double check this before I say that this is.
You can't trust anything from it because it can completely. I've seen times where I feed it, like I'm having it critique myself, right? And I'm having it critique, and it's giving me feedback. And sometimes it's giving me feedback off stuff I didn't even write.
It imagines that I
wrote all this stuff, and it's like, oh, yeah, correct this phrase here. I'm like, I never wrote that phrase. Mm-hmm. So it literally can hallucinate in the weirdest ways, but I just want to make the point that you're talking about like this whole idea of wanting to have people compensated for, you know, their works or whatever, but what that's effectively doing is getting people to say, well, I don't want to have AI scan my stuff at all. Like the New York Times, The Guardian, other papers have just said, you know, don't scan this at all. So this is a high quality text that it's not getting, going to end up getting lower quality text, and then as a tool overall, then it's going to have the problem you're talking about. It's not very good at necessarily rewording things.
I've seen parody, like there was a parody comic at one point talking about how, you know, if AIs are only learning from public domain stuff, everything they know is going to be 95 years out of date. So you know, there is a danger.
But I think your point about misinformation is probably, that's the one I'm most afraid of. I know a scientist at Los Alamos who used ChatGPT, and he used his own name to, tell me how, so I'll pin in his name as John Smith. Tell me how John Smith plagiarized the most recent data on his paper about so and so and so and so, and falsified the data on this, and he wrote this, and it spewed out this beautiful story about how he. So first off, he had never written such an article, and he had never had such data, but it spewed out this beautiful description of how he'd stolen all this data, plagiarized it, how he'd made money off of it, and how his and then it went into his past works and how it now and you know so and. This network is now looking into whether or not any of his work is good and stuff like that. So he went
Did you see the lawyer who asked AI to do its research for?
But it had all these references. It cited all these references, and so he then went in and said, "This reference doesn't exist." And I'm not familiar enough with ChatGPT or how he iterated with it, but he iterated with it and said, you know, this reference doesn't really exist and it's incorrect. And ChatGPT came back and it had all these lawyerly excuses. I'm not going to pick on you again. But, you know, it was like, in fact, that reference we changed the names or something like that to protect the guilty. And then it had all these excuses for why they were not lying with all these phony references to the guy. It was phenomenal how
dangerous. It'll say, you're absolutely right, and come up with something.
A lot of times it's going to do, it's like, oh, you're right, and I am sorry for doing
this.
I think the issues with royalties and things like that will be worked out.
I hope so. I think they will.
What is your take on that?
It's going to take a couple of years.
I think I can only speak for the I'm going into that meeting with marching orders from people who are right holders and who represent authors and artists and journalists and things like that. And the deal that I'm allowed to really talk about, all of them involve some kind of ongoing annual or quarterly payment to those organizations that then distribute it among their members.
So there's
no lump sum check that's going to make this problem go away. They're going to have to, the only deal they're going to get done, otherwise this is going to be, it's going to be a bloodbath in the court, and it's frankly going to devolve into an existential exercise for all these companies, of which, I mean, you have to, why is Microsoft is in this game. Why is Microsoft in this game? The whole AI thing, because they see it as the only chink in the Google search armor. The fact of the matter is that the thing that scares Google, or Alphabet today, and Meta at all, is that each of them have their own duopoly or hegemony. And what they're really afraid of is that this AI, the AI models today are actually what's hitting against the search engine. When you run a search through the AI, in the background, it's generating 10, 20, 50 different queries to the different search engines, getting API call data back, payloads back, and it's processing that and generating a response to you. More and more of the search traffic they're seeing is not being generated by people going to, do you feel lucky and hitting the button on Google? It's coming from the AIs themselves. The AIs, there's the query with Bing built into ChatGPT 4 now. That's a whole other kettle of fish from a race. But their real concern is that for Google gets something like 90%+ of their revenue stream is at least somewhat tangentially related to their search modeling. What Bing sees is they see what that's why they gave, and they didn't pay $10 billion for stock. They're using a blend of compute credits in the future for facilities that OpenAI will be running on and haven't even been built yet. But it's a way that the order is about to be shaken up, because the query for things like search as a hegemony with Google are about to be broken up. So what's the largest pool of social communication that's been generated in the last 5 years? Well, it's there with social media companies. So that's your Twitter. Why do you think Elon is doing this whole X, AI, Grok, whatever thing?
And Facebook is
all because it's all this. All these businesses run, all AI businesses, they all run on the same three pillars. It's been like this for 40 years. So I'm going to come right from that. It's data, it's algorithms, and it's compute. The big thing that's leapfrogged ahead right now has been the compute. We had a lot of data for training for a long time. We just had so much we didn't know how to handle it all. The algorithm stuff, transformers versus some of the convolutional neural stuff, that's a big improvement. That's the reason why automatic translations have become usable, right? That's transformer model working for you there. It's the T and GPT, right? but it's the compute that's really doing it. All this stuff has been around in the literature and working in labs on little tiny scales for 35, 40 years. The thing that's different is that now the compute is large enough and it's ubiquitous enough that you can start to apply it to problems that people actually care about, and then let you start to forget that these models don't have any kind of will, volition. There's no purpose. There's no drive behind them. There's no anima. They're not really. They're basically, you know, you ever make a text message where you just take the next suggestion that pops up? That's really all these things are doing. That's the raw model for these things. And you fine tune them with another layer of AI on.
With just more connections to make to predict the next one.
Yeah, there is no GPT model. There's actually over a dozen of them, and they're linked together, and each one of them has a different expertise in terms of how it was trained. And then there's a layer on the outside that figures out based on what you asked it to do. Which expert probably knows the one? Two of them know how to do a lot of coding, a lot of programming. There's another one that knows about basically the equivalent of most undergraduate degrees worth of just fact knowledge. And it wraps the decision and gets the answer. And then there's some gatekeeping on the back end to make sure that it doesn't spout out something that sounds like Hitler. I mean, that's basically how they're all built. They're
yeah.
matrix of experts.
It's a great explanation. The ones that takes them all to get to not sounding like Hitler
yeah.
takes a bit of work.
It's a lot of that, and that's also where they deal with things like, I was trained in 2021, 22, and I just don't know that. So then it'll launch,
yeah.
imagine, a Google search to go out and find that data and fill in the pieces and refresh the answer
of
it.
Well, that's another piece of it
data.
Is that, like, Google and Bing are searching in real time, but, like, ChatGPT still has a knowledge cutoff, doesn't it?
It moved up to 2023.
Is it 2020?
It's April 2023 is now the new cutoff.
Okay, so that's more...
Yeah. And that's because it takes many, many weeks in order to actually brew up the raw model. And those raw models are kind of like the clay, and you can machine the clay, sort of shape them into doing different things.
I do think
things
they do better in the small, like, rewriting sentences, you know, I'm not to, or it's when you ask for large-scale stuff that if it gets a little off track, it begins believing its own lies, and you can go all sorts of wild places.
I've actually seen that it seems to do better with the large scale stuff. It's inaccurate.
Mm.
It does better with the large scale stuff in terms of like generating a storyline or something like that. But it doesn't, like in fiction, it doesn't understand tempo and timing. Authors say it all the time, this sentence needs another beat. And that just, that might even be nothing.
Well, but that's, it's all depends on how you
ask
the question.
But I'm talking about when I'm reading something, I can spot AI because of that lack of tempo. Or it's a really amateurish, unskilled writer who's doing it. And that I think is stuff that they can ultimately overcome.
But the thing that always gets me with that is people, when they're talking about that, so that's ChatGPT 3.5, not 4.0. There are world differences between how these two things go about wording things. So the stuff that you're talking about, ChatGPT 4, if you give an example, I want things worded like this, and you give it an example, it will word things like that, and it will meet the criteria that you want. It can do that, but people keep using the free version of 3.5, you know, the free version out there, which is 3.5, which sucks by comparison. The example I always give is that 3.5 in doing the bar exam is at the bottom 10%. 4.0 is at the top 10%. There is orders of magnitude difference between these two different versions of ChatGPT when it comes to the English language. So a lot of these ones where they're talking about, oh, it's horribly written or whatever, that's 3.5.
Joe, the thing is, you have the expertise, you have the expert knowledge to know that. The vast majority of writers, other users, don't. And so they only know what they've experienced.
All I'm saying is that ChatGPT it is just amazing what it can do if you know how to tell
that
it
may be
what
true,
to do.
Well, that gets into prompt engineering, like the whole field of needing people who are trained. And actually, I find that kind of an interesting field to know how to ask questions in the right ways.
Right.
Yeah, that's really what it's because I'm a computer programmer by background. I've had AI classes
in some ways,
and so all that helps me to know how to ask
at its best,
the right questions.
When it's at its best, it's natural language programming, which is kind of awesome. I mean, I've worked with models where it's just trying to get you to, you know, program your database using language instead of you know, having to code.
And then, like, now the recent thing that OpenAI releases, now you can customize your own version of ChatGPT to do stuff. And so now people are, like, programming. I love it. Programming just via pure text that they want it to be able to do this kind of thing. It's a task. So they get a custom-made version of ChatGPT-3 that can, I don't know, like, one was, like, creating animated GIFs and doing all this kind of stuff. I mean, it's amazing.
No one wants to be the app. They want to be the app store.
There's another governor safety switch that's been turned on by a lot of companies. If you want to publish a book on Amazon right now, you have to check a box and swear. And if you look at you have to check a box that says, I did not use any AI in generating this content. And then you have to check another box, the bigger box of, I agree to the terms and conditions. And if you look at the terms and conditions, they're pretty nasty about using AI content.
So it's not that simple. It's generative content versus AI assist. So
I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is the companies, the larger companies are making sure that people who are submitting content are not submitting anything in which generative AI was used to generate the content.
But then it's like, if you say if you say it simply that way, then anybody that uses Grammarly, period. Anybody that uses Grammarly is using generative content to some extent because of how Grammarly works.
But
really is AI assist. So they're
really trying to guard against is that a lot of these companies, like Amazon in particular, they want to know that the content, whether or not it's machine generated, because if you use machine generated content in order to train, you know this, right? If you cannibalize, it's like mad
cows.
They
don't want to get sued.
If you feed generated content to a raw model process, you generate garbage, right? Is that they want to know that the content that they're getting from you was written by a person, because then it's useful for more than one person.
But they also don't want to get sued. And they don't know where the ground hasn't settled. They don't know where it's going to settle. And it's not going to settle for at least a couple of years, do you? Who can guess?
10.
Pardon me?
10.
10? Okay. I was trying to be really liberal on that, but it's not going to settle for a while. And so I think that checkbox is going
to
be there on Amazon,
Barnes
& Noble, Kobo, all those sites. They got to protect their ass.
I do think you're right that, like, AI assist is a whole different thing from here, right? My novel.
And the thing is, for me, it's...
What is the cutoff point? Like, if you generate some text and then you edit it and massage it?
The way it's...
Well, that's one of the things we are working on.
They haven't defined that cutoff point. Okay.
Well, hold on.
You can define it today to your satisfaction, but I don't think that's his...
No, I
agree. It's 80% of it is garbage, but some of it is good. And maybe I want to use it. Like, it just generates ideas. Mm-hmm. But I know I take out the garbage, edit it till it's acceptable.
So the rule is that they have, not that I agree with it, is that if it starts off as generative, right? So you get that, and it doesn't matter how much you edit it, it's still considered generative. If you start off with something that you wrote and you give it and you let it do whatever it wants and however it wants, then it's yours. So the one where it's your stuff that starts off and it does whatever to it, that's AI assist.
You said the rule that they have. Who is
Amazon?
Amazon
with the...
How do you know this rule?
Well, I'm talking about... This was in October when Amazon put forth the announcement that anybody who's going to put something on Kindle Direct has to check this box of whether or not it's generative content. Now, the thing is, you're telling them, but they're not telling anybody else yet. So it's not as though if you click it, everybody's going to know that you clicked that box or not. And if you violate the terms and conditions, though it's not sure how they would know this, but if they see that you provided generative content, right, and you didn't click the box, then you can get banned, right? So that's
really... It also costs them nothing to gather the representation from you, right? It costs them nothing to ask you for the representation, right? You're the one making the representation. Like, there's a... It's like,
yeah.
It works 101. cost them nothing to ask you to represent that the data was generated, was not generated, whatever. It costs them nothing to do that now, and they just put it in their back pocket.
How about there's also checkers like zero GPD. You can run it through there.
Yeah.
And they report that this is not AI. It was not generated by AI. Mm-hmm. Where I had generated some AI content and edited it.
So the thing about these, any of these AI detectors, they can give false positive as well. So there was this, I remember in this New York Times, there was an interesting article about this professor who failed everybody in his class because he put the stuff into an AI checker and it said, yep, it's all AI generated. Mm-hmm. And what was actually the case is maybe some of it was, but a lot of it was non-English speakers.
Yes,
and the way they tend to word things is very much the way ChatGPT 3.5 tends to word things.
Yeah,
and it's very hard to know for sure that this came from AI or this came from a human. You're not going to be able to know 100%. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a likelihood, some likelihood there. And so I don't know, like you, how they would possibly make that decision.
Well,
but
what gives it more is the content, which will be quite coherent. Mm. I mean, if you fed it without massaging it. It's like the prose will all be okay, and then you realize it doesn't quite
all
make
the transformer
sense.
Models, though, interestingly enough, their sentence lengths all fall on a normal distribution, and no one's 100% sure why. It's always between 17 and 34 words. The reason why they don't write well and why the rephrasing usually drives people crazy is one of the few more reliable ways to detect it. There's about 20 different signals, but one of them is they use semicolons wrong.
Oh, I've noticed
basic stuff.
I have noticed that
Oxford
so many
commas,
times.
And they don't get long, like correct long sentences, it can't do, and short sentence length, it can't do. So that's the reason why a lot of times it's the rewrites are trying to fit the sentence length, the word length, in a certain distribution. I don't know why somebody would do that, but that's the way that all of them kind of,
so,
regardless of which version of the transformer models,
so
are,
you mentioned,
all of them kind of spit that out in a bell curve distribution, and they're short.
So in fact,
there's
another factor here. You mentioned, for example, the Oxford comma. Mm-hmm. The job of a copywriter at a publisher is to help find typos and errors and mistakes.
Mm-hmm.
But the second part of their job is to make sure that your manuscript adheres to their punctuation requirements, their punctuation guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised when, you know, the first time a publisher edited my manuscript, that this publisher had a rule that you will always include the Oxford comma. You familiar what I mean by Oxford comma? Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You will always include, that is their publishing guideline, and when they publish it, it's going to be included. And so you have these, and the problem that they face is that copy editors are not the highest paid people in the world. That's usually a junior startup position. So they can't give them a broad guideline that, you know, here's how, when you'll use the eye, here's when you won't, and usually, and they don't want to give them judgment. So they tend to come up with these really hard rules. We will always use it or we won't use it. Whereas in fact, always using it or not using it can actually create problems one way or the other. Always using it can create, not, sometimes you don't want to use it just because it makes it clear, sometimes you do. And but they can't do that with a lower paid starting position like a copy editor. And so they have these strict requirements in their punctuation, and they're not always right. So that, I think, it occurred to me when you mentioned that, and this is not a thought that I had before, that muddles the picture even further.
Yeah.
I'm realizing we're almost
4 minutes.
At the end of time.
Closing comment?
I was going to say, if you want to watch AI lie convincingly, ask it something along the lines of, could be all a list of all the prime numbers that are divisible by 2. anything math, but that's like, and if that doesn't work, ask for the ones that are divisible by 3.
or ask it when the island of Crete, what time the island of Crete crossed the finish line of the New York Marathon last year.
Well, that's
and it will give you, I don't know, it's a, I I did this in front of them, I'm sure that they're checking for right now. But you spit out like some very convincing answers about how, you know, or a city, what the city name was.
I think it's worth knowing.
The city of San Francisco across the finish line, record setting, 2 hours and 19 minutes, you know, was beaten out by, you know, some guy from Kenya.
I can also share my one moment where I got like through the randomness, got something that almost seemed profound when I had told an AI, you know, pretend you are a surly teenager who can only respond in 3 words to all sentences.
Oh, wow.
And we went back and forth and I finally said, well, what do you want to ask me? And it said, why people die? And I said, well, I don't know, to you? And it said, no one knows. And I said, then why did you ask me? And the AI said, well, what do you know?
Wow.
And I both see how that came out of the randomness. I have no illusions that there's intelligence
yeah.
in there, but it was sort of one of those moments that it's
like,
weird
things
wow.
You constrain them. When you put constraints on them like that,
they do
what's really doing
things.
In the background is it's generating, like, it keeps generating proposed answers, and then it'll find one that's 3.
Right.
And that's the one that gets picked out.
So my closing statement, it's all bullshit. 5 to 10 years from now, we won't be talking about AI.
I agree with you. On the other hand, I get to go to San Francisco and have dinner some on too.
Yay!
Which I feel like there's going to need to be a leap forward in what it is.
You got 30 seconds.
Sir?
Yeah.
You're obviously an unofficial panelist. I do not seem to remember that you're an IP lawyer, but what is your name?
John Brown.
How do you spell that?
John Brown. Brown, like the color,
LED.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for listening to the Creative Playin' Podcast Network. If you enjoyed our show, please check out D&D Journey of the 5th Edition and Ragnarok Enroll a Scion Hero to Ragnarok Story. Also, check out our Patreon page for more content and behind-the-scenes things, as well as joining us for a one-shot game or two.